I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Susan Musgrave's A Taste of Haida Gwaii, Food Gathering and Feasting at the Edge of the World, is already a bestseller and just a marvelous book that's so much more than a cookbook. It's a chronicle of life and a place in the world that those who've gone to love and those who haven't long to. Haida Gwaii, once known as the Queen Charlotte Islands, fosters a sort of community that's unique. Geography and isolation force you to do that, I suppose, but what emerges is a resourcefulness and practicality that is born in consuming the food that's around you. And what one can find in and around Haida Gwaii is not only fascinating, but delicious. It looks delicious, at least. And having not been there, reading the book and talking to Susan again shortly will certainly want to make you go there. The book features stories about the people and places in Haida Gwaii that give the region a character to itself. The book is often funny, and the recipes can be made wherever you are. I'll be trying a couple over the holidays myself. The history of the community is also fascinating. You'll read this book and not only be entertained, but informed about this part of the world. Susan Musgrave has published nearly 30 books. She's been acclaimed for her work as an editor, as well as for her poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and children's books. She is the 2014 recipient of the Matt Cohen Award in celebration of a writing life from the Writers' Trust, among many other accolades. She teaches in the Creative Writing Department at UBC. She has lived on Haida Gwaii since the early 1970s and owns and manages the Copper Beach Guest House there, which you can find out more about at copperbeachhouse.com. This new book is published by Whitecap. Visit susanmusgrave.com for more. At Musgravian is her Twitter handle. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program from Masset, British Columbia today, Susan Musgrave. Ms. Musgrave, good morning.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So when we talked 2 years ago about that collection of poetry you edited, we talked mainly about poetry, but I mean, I remember beginning the conversation about Haida Gwaii and this place that you live up at. This new book has taken me there in a way. I mean, I've mm-hmm. never been there before. It's given me, as the title says, a taste of Haida Gwaii.
Yes. Well, that was the intention. But it did more. I mean, I hadn't... when you work away at something over a period of 4 or 5 years, as I did this book, you forget that you put the work into it. So when I look at the book now, I think, when did I do that? My husband said, oh, I remember every time I talk to you, it was that cookbook. Why am I doing this? But then the end result is this amazing kind of testament to the community here. And people just love it because it's like a community effort in a way. I feel I was just the catalyst that put it all together. But it's hard to do a book that talks about Haida Gwaii in a real way because there's this whole mystical aura around the place. And so most of the books that have come out are kind of coffee table books, lots of lovely photographs. Mm-hmm. It's a very photogenic place. But to get the kind of capture of the people, you have to live here. You can't just sort of visit for a week and go away. And you have to, that northern sense of humor, you kind of have to live here and be part of it, I think.
I guess the sense of humor, does it come from the isolation?
I think partly. It's like what do you call that, prison humor, the gallows humor, mm-hmm. that people make jokes on their way to the gallows. I think I have a quotation of Sartre's, genius is not a gift, it is the way one invents in desperate situations. Always loved that definition. And I think here, everyone's a genius because you have to kind of be on top of it just to survive. You have to be, make sure you have food because the ferry might not come. So, you know, we all raid the co-op for the last of the milk and things like that. So you're constantly, it's not just like in the city where you can go to the store and buy anything. It's, you may not get it, you know, there may not be a ferry for a month and then what do we do?
Yeah. Are the prices like we're hearing the folks up north where it's like $27 for a jug of orange juice?
I mean, no, not that bad.
No.
A jug of orange juice here is probably 7 or 8.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But, you know, it's bad enough.
Yeah.
You go to the co-op and buy 2 grocery bags, it'll be $150. Just had a friend from the Coast Salish Nation, and he was up here, and all he did was put on Facebook about the prices. He was horrified.
Yeah.
But you get used to them. You know, you think, oh... nothing for that's a gas is $1.60 a liter, for instance, and he went to a Chinese restaurant in Queen Charlotte, and they ran out of fried rice. And he said, "What kind of Chinese restaurant runs out of fried rice?" And I said, "Only on Haida Gwaii."
Yeah. So we're talking a couple of days before Christmas. What's Christmas like for you up there on Haida Gwaii?
Very low key. Where my guest house is, Coffer Beach House, we face the government docks, and there are three or four boats to put lights on, and they're reflected in the water, and it's really beautiful because usually if people put lights up, they blow down. Or there's one snowman, somebody said, in front of one of the few stores in Massett, and somebody sort of kicks it in the crotch every year, and they don't seem to. It's an inflatable snowman, and they don't fix it, so mm-hmm. it's just boot print, which to me epitomizes Christmas up here. Again, that kind of there's a desperation about it all. But there are a few houses that have lights, and I actually have those elf lights this year that I'm totally fascinated. I run outside every half hour to look at them. Those ones that are a laser projection.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And they look great in the middle of the forest when there are no other lights around, because they're just so magical. I imagine in the city they'd get lost, and I think you're not supposed to use them near an airport because you could lure a plane down. That would be kind of disastrous. But I saw them at Butchart's Gardens and just fell in love with them. I thought, I have to have those. They were in a really dark forest. And so my neighbors think I made Stephen climb up a tree and put them up. They don't realize it's a laser. It's quite funny.
The food, I guess, is a big part of life. It's a big part of Christmas. So, I mean, what's the feast like for you guys for
Christmas?
Well,
the Mennonites who live at Fort Clements and have cleared a lot of land have raised turkeys now and chickens and all sorts of meat and beef and pork. And so I order a Mennonite turkey. We do get a free turkey from some community grant, but I prefer to buy the ones that are local.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of feasting that goes on. So Christmas Day I'll go over to my friend Wendy Riley's, and Barb Lawrence is cooking a ham, and then Stephen will make tortiere, and it's just everybody brings something. It's food's a huge part of our life here, which is one of the reasons I decided to put this cookbook together, or this, not really a cookbook, I call it a love story with recipes,
yeah.
Because it's a love story about these islands and the people who live here, or for them anyway.
Yeah, you get to meet the people that you encounter. And some of them, unfortunately, are dead. But you get the stories that are still talked about to this day amongst all of you in that community there.
Right. And I think story is what lasts. I mean, we all have stories, you know, about people who have died. And it's the stories that outlive us. So I wanted to write those down. And there's so many great stories here. And, yeah, it is too bad that they're... And the dogs, I don't know if you noticed the section. When I had a book of poems out a few years ago, I included the names of three dogs in a poem. And... I sold multiple copies of the book to the owners. So I got the brilliant idea that if I put pictures of dogs in this book, I intersperse it with the bread, sourdough bread recipe, that people would buy even more copies. In fact, one person bought 14 copies because there are dogs in there. So I've hit upon something.
And
very popular.
Yeah, and the thing that struck me is this community, because I live in Vancouver. I've lived in Vancouver my whole life. And, you know, we don't really know our neighbors most of the time. And you know everything about your neighbors. And is that a hindrance to, say, living your life the way you'd want to live your life, maybe?
I don't find it a hindrance. I suppose it could be if... But I stay out of the kind of gossip circles, and I don't know if there's gossip about me. I don't hear it, and I don't really want to. It's what they say in AA, what other people say about me is none of my business.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel that it's you can be very isolated here within a community, or you can have as much contact with people as you want, and they'll leave you alone, and which is what I like. So if there are times when I feel socialist, as my daughter would say, I will go and call somebody or visit or go for a walk with one of my neighbors. There are quite a few. There are really a lot of interesting. Michael Koenig and Sunny, his wife, are from Germany. He's an opera singer. He goes all over he's in Frankfurt and Milano, just all over the place singing for like 3-4 months at a time. Then he comes back here. So it's just there's so many fast. The stories are amazing. And I think that, I'm not in that, if there's gossip and kind of mean things being said, I try to stay out of it because one of the great things about being older is you do get a little bit wiser and you realize that it's all it's all temporary, even our heartbeats.
Yeah.
So to the huge things that blow up, tempests and teapots around here, they blow over. And, you know, I've been a part of a few of them myself, and then now then you just sort of hug and make up, and maybe it takes 2 or 3 years, but you eventually have to get along because you might need each other.
And this idea of time, I mean, you know that firsthand living in Haida Gwaii, because it's pretty much the same that it was, say, hundreds of years, centuries ago. I mean, the Copper Beach House, which you own, that's been there about 100 years, right?
Mm-hmm. 101 years this year.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think things are exactly the same, and we do have technology. We didn't have cell phones until about 3 or 4 years ago.
Really?
And well, we have internet, very slow. It's a satellite system I have. In town, you can have cable, but it's not. I think it's more the pace and the lack of. There are fewer people. I've just been on Vancouver Island driving for 10 days, and it's really hard to not lose your patience when you're in the kind of traffic or driving with people who do stupid things. Because up here, you hardly are on the road with another car, so you have a lot of space to do whatever you want. I drive in the center of the road because that way if a deer jumps out, I have more chance of hedging my bets. So
yeah.
If I did that in the city, I'd probably be dead within the first kilometer. But,
yeah,
that's just the way newcomers are very nervous. I explain, I'm driving this way because in case a deer jumps out.
Yeah.
But it's not the same as 100 years. I think in some ways, when we still go, the fun part is when there's wash-up, that's when there's a lot of wind and the shellfish, like the razor clams and the butter clams and rock scallops and weather vane scallops and some abalone, but not very many, just wash in on the tides, and you can tell where there's wash-up because there'd be a lot of seagulls sitting there eating, and just walk over and cockles. That's, we got a lot of cockles a few months or so ago. And I really love doing that. It just feels great to be on the beach. I find I'm always singing when I'm on the beach. And there's no one else there. Like, you have just the birds and the sand, miles of sand, and all this food washing in.
It's yeah, and
lovely
you,
time.
You talk in the book about some of the things that you found, coconuts, for example.
Yeah.
There's a picture in the book that had me chuckling with all the bags of Doritos. And I thought
right.
It was a staged photo or like a comedy piece or something. But that actually happened.
Oh, all sorts of weird things. Container ships hasn't been for a while, but there were picklehead dolls all over the beach 1 year, and then computer monitors another year, and lumber. And of course, since the tsunami in Japan, there's been lots of tsunami debris, but it's mostly styrofoam. It's unfortunate. We can just pick up truckloads of huge, big blocks of styrofoam from the oyster farms. Lots of bottles with Japanese, Korean, Chinese writing on them. I went out there with Doug Copeland. He was going to do some installation with the garbage. And He knows the difference between, he said, oh, that's not Japanese, that's Chinese, or it was Korean. I thought it was interesting because I don't know the alphabets. So it comes from all over, and sometimes just fishermen throwing things overboard. Lots of vegetables wash up, lemons. I'm sure they're just from people who are throwing stuff out of their icebox on their fish boats. But it's quite exciting when you find these things.
Yeah, and about those Doritos, were they edible at all?
Well, they were in bags. I mean, they were sealed still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
There was one I wanted to do as a joke, but I didn't, of green banana, the green banana wash-up, and it was in the Netherlands, but it looked exactly like the beach here. But then I thought, oh, if somebody really tries to, you know, Google this, they'll find out. They might not trust anything else in the book, but it was so perfect. So I have, everybody remembers the green banana wash-up of 1987.
Yeah.
Of course, nobody would really question it, because that's the sort of thing that does happen. But it's just hilarious. The beaches are covered with whatever that is, whatever food it is, it's washed off the ships.
So you first made it up to Haida Gwaii in the early 1970s. Did you feel at home right away?
Oh, yeah. I was living, we'd moved from Ireland to Cambridge, and my friend Sean Virgo was teaching and not very happy there. And I came home for Christmas and then came up here to visit. My publisher of my first book had moved up here and was working for Macmillan Bloedel, lived in Port Clements. And so I came up, it was in December, and I went back to England and said, let's move. And we'd both been spending a lot of time in the Ethnology Museum, where it's full of artifacts from here. So it was the Haida culture that first really drew me. It took me 40 years to get to the village of Skangwai, which is where I had this kind of romance. Well, it is a very romantic place, but that's where I wanted to get, but it was so expensive to get there, it took me a long time. But we moved here, it was 72, I guess, and then I was here for about 4 years, and went back to Ireland, and but kept coming back here. It was definitely my spiritual home for many years, and it's like having a love affair when you have to leave somebody. You go through this withdrawal, and I was miserable, and I go back down to Victoria and just be impossible to be around because I just left the love of my life, which was these islands.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do feel that about it. And people will say things like, I feel I've lived here in a past life. That's very common. It's so common that I'm almost embarrassed to say it. You know, I don't. I felt that too, but I think, whoops.
Yeah.
I'm in the vast majority here.
And so you spend most of your time there now?
I do. Well, I'm still away, you know, once every month to 6 weeks I seem to go somewhere. So it's usually related to work or to see my grandchildren. And my mom's 89. She's in Victoria. So there's a lot of family down south still.
Yeah.
It's a great contrast to have to be able to come back here after being away anywhere in the busy world. It's just beautiful. But I more and more really just like being here.
Yeah.
Through every season.
And people have said this who've been there, is that they learn something about themselves just being there. And for you, does that constantly happen?
I think so. It's because you don't have a lot of distractions of the things you would have in cities. I mean, there are events that, you know, people come here to give poetry readings, and there's some dance recitals, and there's not as much. Like in the city, you have so many things to choose from every day, every night that you could do, and we tend to just go for walks. And when visitors come in the summer, tourists are used to now doing things, like they want to rent a paddleboard, or they want to rent a bike, or they want to go zip lining. Well, we don't have anything like that. So I try to tell people, just try and be. It's not a doing place. We don't have that. What is that infrastructure?
Yeah.
Hardly even any restaurants. We have one very good restaurant here. So it's a place where you just go and sit on a log, and you probably will see a whale swim by. But we don't have whale watching tours or bear watching tours. And I think people like that because that way it's a more organic approach to life. There you are walking along the river and there's a bear on the other side. It's not laid on for you.
Right.
And I think that people really like to be surprised. I mean, not in a bad way, but the bears here have so much food they don't chase you. But that when you come across something that you hadn't expected, I think it's much better than some reading a guidebook and seeing where you should go to see whatever it is you want to see. So I just tell people trust, because up here, if there's something you want to see, a friend of mine was saying yesterday, she wanted was a, her mother was here, and her mother wanted a white eagle feather, and she said, oh, if the Creator would just send me a white eagle feather, and she said, surely enough, an eagle flew over, and this white eagle feather came down at her feet, and you hear so many stories like that. It's just, and I don't know if it's because people become receptive here to that, you know, more of that reality, or you have time because there's not so much else to look at other than the wilderness. So whether you're, you know, just more in tune with it, therefore those kinds of things happen. I really don't know why, but they do. I think that's called synchronicity, and there's a lot of that here.
So I learned a lot about food from the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I hadn't heard of before, and it makes a lot of sense, is that when you're storing your eggs, I guess, in the fridge, you put them the fat side up.
Right. Well, what I did when I was writing, every ingredient I would start, that I used, I'd start researching, and I learned so much myself, and of course, I only really like to write if I'm going to learn something, because otherwise, why bother? But I'd totally forgotten about that. Do I keep my eggs that way? Probably not, but it was so that there's air, it doesn't, what was the reason?
Yeah, the air is at the top, I guess, and if you put them the fat side up, the air doesn't collect at the bottom or whatever the direction is. And
so
there's
many
no
tips
bacteria.
And with tomatoes, you should, I think you're supposed to keep them a certain way too.
Yeah, stem down.
But it takes a while for those things to sink in when I read some new tip. I know that you shouldn't keep tomatoes in the fridge, although, as I say in the book, Bob Frommeni, who is finest at sea, he says he likes his tomatoes in the fridge. So what I learned about food is you cannot, there's nothing definitive. Everybody has their own way, and they'll think it's right. And you might as well just accept that. And I just am always interested in finding. I just learned the other day that when you roast vegetables, you shouldn't put salt on them to begin with, because it will draw the moisture out, and you'll have steamed vegetables instead of caramelized. Well, I think I say in my book to put salt with them. So already, since the book's come out, I changed several recipes and have learned more. So
Yeah.
It's a process. It never ends. Of course, there's no such thing as a recipe that's ever finished, I don't think. Some I do make the same thing over and over, cookies. But, you know, there's certain combinations. There's a lot of chemistry in baking, especially. I'm always amazed at people who don't measure when they bake. I think, how can they do that?
Yeah, so you do measure when you bake. You have to. Yeah. But
only when I bake. Yeah. I certainly don't measure when I'm making the Irish whiskey stew or the deer stew that has whiskey and three types of onions. And I don't. But that was the difficult thing about writing a cookbook, is the editor wants you to have specific amounts. So if I would say a pinch of gold flake, he'd say, well, how many flakes of gold would that be? And I'd say, well, I don't know. Then I got defensive. I'd say things like, well, if that's what you want to know, you shouldn't be reading this kind of book. And that's, you can't, of course, say that. But lots of times I just would say a daub of butter or a glug of something, and that's the way I cook. And I think there are a lot of people who cook that way, but I notice that when I have a new recipe, I also want to know. I'll look and say, well, how much butter do they say, do they suggest? And I like to have precise amounts myself.
Yeah, like a clam chowder, and you say this in the book, I mean, it never comes out the same.
No, it doesn't. Because I often add little leftover bits of things to cooking, which I couldn't do in the cookbook either.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I have a little bit of salsa, I might throw that into some rice dish. That's just the way you cook. You want to use up things and not have them go to waste.
Yeah.
And my kids call me the leftover queen, because I was always able to do great things with leftovers.
And you carry salt in your purse?
What's that?
You carry salt in your purse?
I do.
Yeah.
Malden.
Yeah, that's that pink stuff, right?
No, it's white.
It's white.
It's big crystals. It's from an old family business in Malden in England.
Mm-hmm.
And I worried when it became popular that we wouldn't be able to get it anymore, but they seem to be producing enough to satisfy everybody.
Yeah.
But it's the best finishing salt I've come across. The pink is Himalayan. I was going to write, I had about 3 or 4 pages about salt, and I had, you know, 10 pages on paprika. The book would have been 1,000 pages. Somebody called it the LaRousse of the North, I liked, but because it is kind of encyclopedic.
Yeah.
Had I included all the research I'd done on all the ingredients, it would be twice as long. Again, it was really something I had to do for myself and then cut it back. And paprika, I always thought of as something you just sprinkled on deviled eggs, and then realized if you were Hungarian, paprika was sort of next to godliness. And there were at least eight categories of paprika. So it became, you know, because I love research, I think, I'd spend days and days on researching ingredients that I was then going to have to exclude from the cookbook, because, of course, we don't grow peppers here to make paprika, and we don't have olive trees. So I wrote lots about olive oil, too, because it's very interesting to me how the olive oil wars and how the stuff we get here sometimes doesn't even have... An olive has never seen the oil in which it's, you know, in the bottle we're buying.
Well, this is a new genre for you, you know, writing about cooking and food.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it seems an extension of the kind of essays I used to write, the creative nonfiction that I did for newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to be able to be more myself in nonfiction than poetry. Just feeds on all the darkness and the neuroses. But when I'm writing nonfiction, I can allow some humor and some light into the work.
Yeah, that restaurant review with Patrick Lane, I mean, that's great stuff.
That's what I really wanted to be, was a restaurant critic.
Yeah.
I'd love to. Except it'd probably get boring even doing that if you just had to go night after night and eat amazing food. You'd probably want something that wasn't so amazing after a while. Or something home-cooked.
Yeah. Yeah. When people go up to Haida Gwaii, do they look for, like, in terms of food, do they look for salmon? Is that what they want to eat?
They do. And the irony here is that you can't buy fresh, you can't go to a restaurant and get fresh salmon. You can in the village, but we have all those laws about government inspection, and so it has to be sent to Vancouver and I think comes back frozen. I think Haida Wild, is a new company in town, can sell it, but it still has to be sold frozen.
Hmm.
So same with meat. You know, we had to send our beef off island to be slaughtered, and you know, the tariff, which is a long, 8 hours on the ferry, and the poor cows, I don't know how stressed they are, but I'm there. So that's just those laws they have, the 52 million laws we have in our government.
Yeah.
It's one of them.
You do something that is quite apt, I think, in the book, is that you talk about someone's fishing spot, for example, where they can find salmon,
mm-hmm.
and you block out where that is.
Right.
And I found that just so profound, because, I mean, why bother knowing where that is. I mean, you find it yourself if you want to, right?
Yeah, and if you were here, you know, the person who I was writing about would take you probably.
Right. Yeah.
I was conscious of this because I know one year when I was first picking Boletus, I put on Facebook, oh, where I found some, and everybody jumped on me and said, you never tell anybody where they grow. And I said, oh, okay, I see. Everyone has their spot. Like the Haida matriarchs used to have their own cranberry bog that belonged to certain families, and you couldn't go there if you weren't from that family or didn't have permission. So there's a kind of respect around certainly medicinal food. When Nancy Turner wrote Plants of Haida Gwaii, she doesn't divulge any sources as to, you know, where anything grows, because we've already had influxes of people from other countries who've come and taken massive amounts of our seafood. Gooey ducks were almost wiped out by the Asian markets in the, I think, the 70s or the 80s. And other abalone, definitely. It just gets depleted if people know where you get it and their commercial ventures. But the average person coming here is, you know, wants to catch a fish. Lots of people catch fish in the rivers and release them.
Yeah.
That's a big thing, too.
And picking wild mushrooms, berries and the sort, I mean, do you have to worry about, say, whatever you're picking being poisonous?
No. Well, you ought to really know what you're picking. I don't think that there are any poisonous mushrooms here. Well, there are. There are Amanita muscaria, but those are the red with the white spots that are pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Chanterelles, the mushrooms I pick, are just brilliantly gold, and they sort of stand out in the day glow green moss. You can't really miss them. And so once you've picked a few, you know what to look for. You know how the gills go up the stem. If you're ever in doubt, you just don't pick it, or you don't take it home and don't eat it. But there really aren't. You'd have to really not know what you're doing to eat a magic, you know, the fairy toadstool.
Yeah.
But it can be lethal. The Amanita panthera is the brown one with white spots, and it definitely is lethal. I think the muscaria, you can eat bits and just start hallucinating, but your heart will also race. No, I never. I mean, the berries. You kind of watch what the birds do too. I talk about this. If the ravens aren't eating the seafood, you don't eat it because there will have been red tide.
Yeah, they know these things, don't they, right?
Things,
yeah.
It's safe. And berries, I think there are some berries that I don't write. There's crowberry, but they're medicinal. They're black. They look like juniper berries. They grow in the muskeg. They're bunch berries. I've never done anything with those. Usually if they're hard and black. Black is, there are not a lot of berries that are black, although crowberries are black, but that they're... and apparently even snowberries, those white berries, you can eat. And I was always told when I was a kid not to, that they were poisonous.
Right, yeah.
But I've read now that they aren't. They just kind of look funny. They look suspicious.
They
their
do,
whiteness.
Yeah. I guess what one wonders after reading this book is what you eat in the course of your day. Do you eat stuff that's prepared from the book? I mean, this past Sunday. What did Susan Musgrave eat that day?
Was yesterday Sunday?
Yeah.
Can I even remember? I had a big piece of Black Forest cake that was made by my neighbor's mother who was here from Germany. We had smoked salmon for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, we did. And we had... refried beans, so that wasn't local, but the smoked salmon was. So I think probably in every meal there's something. I use spruce tips. I always sprinkle on the smoked salmon, and they're local. For dinner, I cooked some. The person at the health food store persuaded me to buy this huge bag of a lifetime supply of brown rice. Now, I'm not a rice eater. I'm really resistant to rice. My background is potatoes, so I love potatoes. They have Haida potatoes here, too, which are look like Jerusalem artichokes. They're really knobby and sort of long. But so I cooked brown rice, and I put I found some tofu in the fridge. I did not eat a Haida Gwaii dinner, but some peas and what else, ginger and garlic. I felt that I needed to eat something, a grain. I don't eat a lot of grains. My body was telling me to eat that, and in fact, it was very satisfying, so... but then I'll make a venison stew. Tonight we're having lamb, which is not indigenous. But I'm making a dessert that's from one of, what's his name, Ottolenghi's books. It is called Bitter Frozen Berries with White Chocolate Cream. So I mix wild cranberries from the bog and blackberries from Queen Charlotte and huckleberries, and then you mix those with Angostura bitters, let them soak for a couple of hours, and then mix them into this kind of whipping cream and chocolate ganache mixture. And it's very light, but really interesting flavors.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of, you know, as I say, there's usually an ingredient in what I cook that will be from here.
Yeah.
So it's the berries tonight.
It just sounds delicious. I'm salivating here.
I realize I'm getting good at describing food. It's one of the hardest things to do when you're writing. I would say that's the mark of a good writer, who could make you, you know, want to eat something. And just as I describe that, well, of course, I'm looking at the picture. I love Otto Lengi's cookbooks. I love the photography in them, too.
The photography in your book is quite good, too.
Well, yeah, there are almost, I think, 49 photographers involved.
Yeah.
Many of them local. And I wanted, again, to get away. It's not the kind of book where you have a recipe on one page and then the photograph on the next. There, mm-hmm. I had, I think, 380 photographs that I wanted incorporated. And partly I thought the publisher would say, we can use 20 of these. So I was shocked. When I designed the book, I put them all, you know, I had to put where the pictures were supposed to go and then send it to the art director. And then I said, oh, my God, they're using them all. This is amazing. So that's why they're smaller than usual.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it would have been really a big book if they'd put full-page pictures.
And I guess after this book, you'll have to raise the rate at Copper Beach House.
Oh, I don't know. Nothing is very high-end up here, so it's not about making money. It's the strangest place. It's really hard for most of us to get into that thing of, I don't even like charging anybody to stay there. I think it's like a bed. Why would I charge for that? But I have to hire somebody to work for me, and they need to get paid, and bills have to be paid. But I'm not really an innkeeper. I don't feel comfortable charging people. I just want them to have a memorable time, and I think a lot of people feel that way up here, is if you take somebody somewhere and just give them a great day by taking them out across the inlet or, you know, on a trip that they wouldn't be able to make if they didn't meet you. It's just so satisfying how happy people are. And we get a lot of people who, I don't like the term bucket list, but we get a lot of people who, you know, who have terminal illnesses, have always wanted to come here. I've got somebody I'm marrying, and I'm a marriage commissioner. Advertise that, but anyway, I'm doing a wedding for someone who has brain cancer, and this is where they've always wanted to come. And so it's very touching. It's the humanity that comes out in people here, and how much the community gives back. I think that's what makes it special. If you came here and didn't meet anybody, you'd probably have quite a lonely time. But once you start meeting people, and all you have to do, we love new people here because we're so sick of each other by after the winter that, you know, anybody. Anybody new will be glommed onto in any of the cafes or anything. So you do quickly meet the locals when you come here, and it's a lovely combination. So people from, and then the people decide to stay. There's a couple here right now. One, she's from the Yukon, he's from Alberta, and they're just staying till the middle of January. But I went and told them about a house that's coming up for rent, because they seem to really fit in, and there are lots of couples in their 20s and 30s who come here and decide to stay, and single people too. Interesting mixture.
Yeah, well, it's a place that I've longed to go to, as I told you a couple years ago. And in the course of reading this book, you've brought me and a lot of your readers there.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a wonderful service for that community.
Oh, that's great. Because I feel that, you know, it's funny how you choose in a way where you're going to spend your life. And I think, why odd that I've chosen this place? It's not odd. It's just, you never know when you're a kid where you're going to end up,
yeah,
or where you will give your life to and what it will give back. But I definitely feel that living here I'm lucky to live here, and want to share that luck with other people. And really love doing this book because of how I was able to include so many people and their dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mustn't forget the dogs. But no, it's, yeah. It feels like a huge family now that I have. I even feel closer to people after this book than I did before, and that's just such a nice feeling. And
yeah.
Even if, as I say, they're not really necessarily best friends, they're just all people I like and admire and who are eking out an existence here but enjoying themselves in the meantime.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm like a lot of people after reading this book, just aching to go there.
Well, definitely we've had, like, we never had bookings at Gopher Beach House before January for say, for next year, but I was getting bookings in September for 2017.
Wow.
Wow, you know. No, there are more people coming, and there are way more places to stay than there used to be. Lots of places out on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter's getting married in July, and they're renting the whole, or we're renting the whole of the High Ellen campsite, which is a Haida-based operation out at Tow Hill. There's 7 cabins and a big longhouse.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of weddings that happen there. So it's, so you know, it's getting, there's more choice of the type of place. There's some people who rent their houses as kind of vacation rentals. And like 20 years ago, that there was none of that. There was really Copper Beach House and a hotel that burned down and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Hotels always burned down here. But now there's a lot of variety in accommodation.
Well, it's something to look forward to, and I'm sure a lot of people have. It's been such a pleasure talking to you again, Susan.
Yeah, you too, and come up and visit.
We'll do, yeah.
We will cook for you.
I can't wait. Okay. Happy Christmas and New Year. All the best, Susan. Thanks
Same
again.
Same to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye, Joseph. Bye.
The book is called A Taste of Haida Gwaii, Food Gathering and Feasting at the Edge of the World. It's published by Whitecap. Its author, Susan Musgrave, joined me on the line from Massett, British Columbia. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.